Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Charles Christian. Before we bring him on, I have just a couple of announcements. We've already started production on the Forbidden documentary. That's right, we broke out the camera, lights, microphones, and we dove right in. But this is going to be much bigger than your average conspiracy doc. It's actually going to be a conspiracy docuseries. We're going to take all of you on the road with Forbidden Knowledge News, as well as your favorite guests that have appeared over the years. Maybe a little example of some of those guests may be authors, researchers, content creators like Matthew LaCroix, Preston Dennett, Brad Olson, Billy Carson, and maybe even some of you listening right now. Topics are including paranormal, ufology, historical conspiracies, hidden ancient history, current conspiracies, spirituality, cryptids, and much more. We're going to visit sacred and spiritual sites and places of high strangeness, and hopefully visit with as many of you along the way as possible. This project is currently completely self-funded, and we're asking for your help. We're going to jump right in head first, like I said, and hopefully the universe and maybe some of our amazing audience will help out a bit. If you would like to get involved with the production, email me forbiddenknowledgenews@gmail.com. And if you'd like to help by leaving a donation, we have a Buy Me a Coffee or PayPal option. You can go to supportfkn.com or use the PayPal link. Any amount is greatly appreciated and will help tremendously. Also, if you make a donation through supportfkn.com, you get access to select chapters from Corey Hughes' upcoming book about the JFK assassination. And remember, Forbidden Knowledge News, always available on Rockfin, Minds, Odyssey, Rumble, all podcast platforms. We're limited on YouTube, and we have many other options for you to get our content. One of those options, Rockfin, is where you get our premium content. You also get all the premium and free content from every creator on Rockfin. You just go to rockfin.com/FKN+. You can now also get all our premium content, just Forbidden Knowledge News premium content, as well as Beyond Classified on Minds for only $5 a month. Check that out. That link is in the description. ForbiddenKnowledge.news is the home of the Forbidden Knowledge Network. That's our website. Those links are all in the description as well. Finally, check out our friends at C60 Purple Power. C60 has been amazing for my personal health. Check it out for yourself. Check out what may be the most powerful antioxidant known to man. If you use the link in the description, you get 10% off your order plus free shipping. Today, I want to welcome back to the show Charles Christian. He is an English barrister turned writer, podcaster, award-winning tech journalist, and sometimes werewolf hunter. He now writes, talks, and makes videos mainly about folklore, urban myths, history, and the weird. Charles, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good to be back talking to you again, Chris. Always enjoy our talks.
Definitely. I've been looking forward to this as well. Last time you were on, we got into some fascinating folklore from England, and we're going to go even deeper today. Some of the things I'm excited to hear about are, of course, more about werewolves, zombies, and vampires. Mm-hmm. And now you're working on a book about witches and sorcerers, which I'm very excited to hear about, as well as let's get into some more obscure stuff like green-skinned fairy folk, headless ghosts, screaming skulls, ancient warlords, and maybe a park and eating dragon. And who knows? But yeah. It's been a while since you've been on, and I'd like you to remind the audience a little bit about yourself and what brought you to this research.
Right. Well, back when I had a day job, I was a journalist and used to write a lot of really heavy stuff, but I'd always had a fascination with what we'd broadly call the paranormal. From university days, and I used to go ghost hunting and things like that long, long time ago. And in recent years, I've been able to escape from the 9 till 5. I'm now writing and investigating and looking into stuff that fascinates me. And I found the stuff that I really like are the weird, the unusual. I suppose it's the realization that a lot of the tales that are told they do have some foundation in fact. It may well have been changed over the decades and centuries, but there was some element of truth there in the very beginning. And it's just scratching back to see where those elements were and where did it come from. And I say that's one of the things I find endlessly fascinating about it. And there's just so much stuff there. The more you look, the more you find.
Yeah.
I think.
For sure. Is there anything...
almost.
No, go ahead and finish.
I was going to say, you know, it's almost a case of the more you look, the more you realize you don't know even a fraction of what's out there. And, you know, one thing leads to another and you follow this and you find that and you follow something else and you go on. So I say it's an endless source of fascination for me.
It is, and that kind of leads into what I'd like to ask about. Has your perception on any of the topics from paranormal, ghosts, witches, has your perception on any of this profoundly changed since you started looking into this, or do you look at something completely different or in a new aspect that may be different than from when you first started?
I think there has been a change in that. Possibly I was a fairly rigid skeptic to start with, and thinking, oh, these stories are all bunk. But then the more I look in, again, going back to that point, you know, the more you realize you don't know, the more I realize it's not black and white. It's not ghosts exist or they don't exist. There's this huge gray area in the middle where almost folklore and science meet. And, you know, you look at some of the science that's being followed at the moment, things like quantum physics and things, and you're almost talking about magic. And you realize that perhaps a lot of the older tales were scientific, but the people at the time didn't understand the science and so ascribed it to supernatural forces. And we're now starting to head that way and possibly find that a lot of what we think of as science is actually very hard to distinguish from the supernatural.
Yes, and as well as I'm finding that over, especially even the past few years, more researchers are finding the profound connections between paranormal activity, UFO activity, what some might consider extraterrestrials or cryptids or ghosts, and they seem to have these profound connections to each other. Have you seen the same sorts of things along the way?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think one thing is that the paranormal and, if you like, psychic research is no longer perceived as unscientific and something to be sneered at. I think the scientific community is becoming more open-minded and prepared to discuss these things, whereas before they were very much on their dignity. And if you believed in the paranormal, then you weren't a real scientist. And I think a lot of scientists are now coming around to the recognition that, you know, it's not as simple as they first thought. I mean, you mentioned cryptozoology. Every year, scientists are finding more and more species of animals that they didn't know existed before. I mean, you know, obviously some of them, they're not very exciting for our point of view. They're frogs and fish and things. But, you know, we don't know everything. And the more we go on, we're more discovering more and more things. I mean, like those sea creatures you see on occasional documentaries that are living by the plumes of hot gases coming out of the ocean beds. You know, they're miles down. They're living in apparently totally inhospitable environment, yet they're thriving and there's communities thriving. And, you know, that in turn is now you're starting to see when people are talking about exploring the planets and the moons of the solar system, they're now conceding, well, there might be life, but, you know, to use the Star Trek term, it's not life as we know it, Jim, but there could still be life there living in frozen waters, subterranean lakes and things on remote planets. And we're starting to realize that the old 19th and early 20th century views of science are outdated, and we need to be a lot more flexible and open-minded.
Yeah, and with some of the research and people that are doing this research are very encouraging to me to see the directions that we're headed, and more people that are actually becoming interested in looking into this stuff is fascinating as well. So I think we're headed into an extremely important time when it comes to discovery and what we consider the unknown or paranormal right now. But I want to start really with you grew up in a haunted house. I think we touched on it, that had some kind of activity. Could you tell us a little bit more, give us some details about what happened when you were growing up?
Yeah. The house is on the by the harbour in a place called Scarborough. And like a lot of old seafront properties, as the port was developed and wharves were built, so the land was stabilized and they would stick more bits on the house. So it was a very mishmash of a house with some really old parts at the back that we know from when my father was doing renovation work were medieval, you know, the timbers and infill, and then a sort of a Georgian bit stuck on the front. So it was a very peculiar house with lots of passageways and doors that led nowhere. And it had been over the years sublet and split up and then joined up again and bits added on. So it defied logic as a property. And I'd say there were some very weird things, like a cellar that you accessed via a hidden staircase that looked like a panel and swung away to reveal an entrance to a cellar area. And there was another cellar that was locked, that was blocked up. I think one element was, given where it was located back in the 18th century and early 19th century, there would have been smuggling activity, and that would have been where people stored their loot that they were smuggled in. But with the actual property itself, there were two things. One of my mother's psychic friends said that she could hear the sound of men in large boots, heavy boots, walking around in the attic room. And I'd never heard them, and my parents hadn't. But we did know that a couple of generations earlier, my would have been great-grandmother used to provide accommodation for seafarers, typically fishermen, whose boats were caught in the harbour in a storm and needed somewhere to stay. So she had a load of beds up in the attic, and there would have been men in large boots because they wore big thigh-length waders, the fishermen of those days, would have been clumping around. The other thing was, there was something that used to shake the bottom of my bed, as if something, it was one of those beds that had a metal frame, and it was as if somebody got hold of the bottom end and tugged it backwards and forwards. And it was a distinct sensation. It wasn't that kind of feeling you get when you're falling asleep and you think you're falling. This was a definite tug, enough to wake you up. And my parents always said it was the wind, but it was only years later when we were clearing out the house that I realized that the way the property was laid out and the way my bed was, it couldn't have been the wind, because the wind would have shaken the house in a slightly different way for where the prevailing winds were. So I've never been able to work out it, but there was definitely something that would just reach at the bottom of the bed and tug it. And I accepted my parents' tales that it was stories, that it was just the wind. And so, it didn't actually frighten me after the first couple of times. I just thought, oh, it's just the wind. But thinking back, I think there was something more to it, and that I was encountering some form of manifestation, but I know not what. And of course, all history now, and it's not possible to go back and evaluate it.
Yeah, and the more we learn about places that have concentrated paranormal activity, there's a few places here in the United States that stand out, like Skinwalker Ranch, places in the Uinta Basin. There's a new place called the Meadow Blind Frog Ranch, and even places like Mount Shasta that have just kind of this different type of energy to it. Maybe you'll have more UFO sightings. Maybe you'll have more paranormal activity. Maybe you'll have more cryptid sightings. But there's always these places around the world that have these areas of high strangeness. And most of the time, they have some kind of strange electromagnetic properties or interference with electronics in that area as well. What makes me wonder, is it something to do with the maybe electromagnetic properties in the area or underground or even above? And I'd like to get your thoughts on some of that.
Well, I mean, just to go to your first point about certain places have an atmosphere, you definitely get that. And obviously in the UK, we've got buildings going back still in use, 1500 years plus, you know, that sort of, particularly some of churches and things that have been built on and reused and developed onwards. And you can't help but go into somewhere like that or some of the old castles that are around. And some of them are still in quite good condition, you know, and still got all the rooms in them and things. And you cannot help but feel there's an atmosphere there. And they're so steeped in history, an awful lot of bloody history as well. And, you know, terrible things happened in those properties that, you know, there is an aura about them. There is a feel about them. And, you know, the classic one in the UK is obviously Stonehenge. You know, and there are a number of other Neolithic properties where, you know, the sun really does shine through a particular stone or a particular direction on the longest day or the shortest day. And, you know, that's really putting yourself in touch with your ancestors, because you were going back then, you know, 4,000 years, and, you know, people have been there treating it as a sacred site for that long. You know, it can't help but have that vibration to it and feel to it. But of course, the chicken and egg question is, does it have this atmosphere because people have been going there for so long? Or was it built there in the first place because there was already an atmosphere to it? And, you know, in the UK, the idea of ley lines is very much following that principle. When you look at some of the leys and the directions they go, and there are so many historic buildings of different eras built on them, you know, from standing stones through to medieval churches and the like. Again, you know, which came first? Was it people detected this vibration, this sensation there, and built shrines effectively, or places to acknowledge it and worship it? Or is it just so many people have been there for so generations, for so many hundreds of years, that it's built it up that way?
Yeah, it is interesting to think about. I mean, or it could be the, like you mentioned, the amount of negative energy or bloodshed that may have happened in a particular area. I know that in the U.S. here, places like Gettysburg, people will go there and they'll actually see a scene from the Civil War playing out in front of their eyes, and it's not really there. It's just some kind of like trapped memory from that area, probably due to the high concentration of, you know, dark energy that was released during that battle. What do you think about that?
I think that's entirely plausible. I mean, we're into the idea of sort of residual hauntings, or the stone tape idea, that traumatic events in a person's life, when there's nothing more traumatic than being killed in a battle or murdered, somehow embed themselves in the infrastructure, you know, a bit like a videotape or audio tape. I mean, that's a piece of plastic with magnetic material on, yet It repeats sound, it carries sound, and it carries images. Is it almost a natural form of a video recording that have been seen? But certainly in the UK, there's plenty of tales of battle scenes where on the anniversary of the incident, sounds or images can be seen of relating back to the battle. In the England, the Battle of, I can't remember if it's Marston Moor or Naseby, but there were two of the big battles during the English Civil War in the 17th century. For a long time, there were tales that on any anniversary, people could see the battle still taking place, and early on, people could even recognize some of the people participating in it.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. Yeah. I want to get back into a little bit more folklore about some of mm-hmm. my favorite creatures, vampires and werewolves. I grew up, you know, watching horror movies, watching movies about vampires, Dracula, werewolves. But the perception people have of these folklore creatures aren't what they originally were supposed to or meant to or actually could have been. It's been changed and manipulated throughout history, and, you know, of course, Hollywood has glamorized and made it something completely different. But I want to go back to some of the earliest kind of cases or stories about vampires and werewolves that we can go to that point to the origins and the truth about what these beings could have really been.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because, you know, you look at werewolves and a lot of what we now regard as werewolf lore can be dated back to the 1930s with the original werewolf movies, the Werewolf of London, and I think it was The Return of the Werewolf. And they popularized the idea that if you shot a werewolf with a silver bullet, the dying werewolf would return to the human form. And I say that really was Hollywood scriptwriters doing it. And obviously, vampire lore, again, a lot of it is what we class as the vampire is just a rerun of Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is, you know, a novel from the turn of the 19th, start of the 20th century. And you know, you encounter people quoting as facts stuff about vampires that come from there. You know, the idea of garlic, that seems to have been a Bram Stoker original idea, but rather than anything else. But I mean, going back in time, they've existed a long time. I mean, you go back and there's tales from the Roman era of creatures that would definitely qualify as vampires. They sometimes call them slightly different names, but the idea of creatures coming back from the dead and taking sustenance from the blood of the living, you know, that's a 2000 plus year old concept, and it was very much something that in the medieval period in Europe that people had in mind and were conscious of and aware of and feared, if you like. So, it, you know, I mean, with the medieval, I did some reading, studying on this when I was writing my book on the Yorkshire Wolds. And the concept they had, they called it a revenant, which we don't tend to use in English anymore, but their idea was that the afterlife was really the dead physically coming back from the dead. So their creatures are, their revenants are really a cross between a zombie and a zombie and a vampire. And, you know, they're shambling creatures of, you know, with decaying flesh, but they also want blood. And that was a very real fear that they had. And, you know, historians of the Middle Ages wrote about them in their chronicles, and you know, described how they would afflict towns and how that they could only be destroyed by cutting their heads off and cutting their hearts out and by burning them. And you know, in the Wold's book, I talk about a village there called Warham Percy, and excavations of the burials there in the medieval church have found about a dozen bodies that had been ritually dismembered. And this was Christian times. They normally were very careful about burying people the right way. But these were people who'd had their heads cut off and their limbs broken, in some instances their legs severed at the knee, and then their heads placed between their legs, usually with the face pointing downwards. And it was very much a medieval idea that to stop the dead from walking, you'd do the same as you'd stop a living person from walking. Chop off the legs, they're not going to walk. Cut off their head, they're not going to be able to see where they're going, especially if you point it face down. And say it's a quite a, by our standards, a rather childish, simplistic approach. But for those times, that was the recipe, that was the menu, and that was how you dealt with them. And I say, this is a little village in the middle of nowhere, just a farming village. And people were obviously sufficiently concerned about it that they took these measures to prevent people from walking, you know, and from doing it. You know, it was a genuine fear, as opposed to just something a few cranks might think. And obviously the fact it was in a churchyard showed that the church approved of that measure as well.
Now, you know, aside from what Hollywood portrays in a few conspiratorial stories about, bloodline families that may prey on children or whatever, we don't really see much about vampires in our modern society as far as actual sightings or people coming into contact with them. But what we do see sometimes is sightings of things that look like dogmen or werewolves or wolf-like creatures, especially here in the United States. Dogmen has become a huge thing, and actually, even lately, we've been getting tons of sightings of these dog-like creatures. And, you know, I'm wondering to get your thoughts on that and if there's any connection to possibly the folklore of early werewolves.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think that's an element, you know, and what's interesting with werewolves, again, there's origins of them going back to Roman times, but they're also in multiple societies. You know, Native Americans have a culture of what we would call a werewolf. In African and India, they have similar cultures, although the creatures are different, and the African ones tend to be, it's not a werewolf, it's a sort of werelion, and in Asia it's the werebear, because you know that they are relating to the creatures that are prevalent in their areas. So, you know, but it's the same thing, this idea that there are creatures out there that are half human, half monster of some form or another. And I say, multiple societies having it, and over a very long period of time, which again, you know, adds to the idea it's not just some Hollywood fad that people are, you know, they've watched the latest movie and they're impressed by it, that this goes back a long, long time. What the origins are, I have difficulty with. I mean, in the UK, we have a lot of tales of big black dogs, unnaturally large ones. And certainly on the eastern coast, which was the area where all the Viking raiders came from. And of course, the Vikings in their mythology, they have a lot of wolves in them. You know, Odin used to be accompanied by a hunting wolf. Ragnarok is all about the, you know, the end of the world is when a giant wolf comes and destroys everything. So there may well be some kind of not quite race memory, but some sort of spiritual memory that, you know, large wolf-like creatures are ominous. And I mean, we use it in our normal everyday language. You know, depression is, you know, you're suffering from the black dog. So it's there. It's been there a long time, this. As to whether men, humans, could ever physically change from being a human being into a wolf and then back again, I think that's stretching the laws of anatomy, just simply that our bone structures are different. You know, we don't just develop a longer nose. Everything else has to change. It would be hard to understand that.
Oh, they show you how that happens in American Werewolf in London.
Exactly. There's a woman I interviewed for a book, and she's an anatomist, and she's written a sort of paper on, you know, all the structures and things that would have to change, and the different things that would grow, and, you know, your jawbones need to grow to get different teeth and so on. But it doesn't stop there being a belief that some people can somehow, I suppose, mentally or spiritually transform themselves into a wolf and behave like a wolf and psych themselves up to be like a wolf. And again, this comes back to the Vikings again, where the berserkers, you know, they dressed in wolf skins, they dressed in bear skins, some of them dressed in boar skins. They psych themselves up with alcohol, drugs, to go into battle. They thought they were invincible. You read reports of them wearing no armor and being the bravest of the brave, rushing in and terrifying everybody, acting not like human beings, but acting like wild beasts. So, you know, I think that is one source of, you know, something, a creature that is part man, part wolf.
That reminds me of the Native American stories here of the possible battles and quarrels between the Ute and the Navajo, that they possibly wore pelts of animals to project themselves as wolves, and that they called themselves skinwalkers. And that's one of the legends that we have out here, and especially associated with places like Skinwalker Ranch, that there's this curse associated with the Navajo and the Ute Native Americans. And that what I thought of whenever you're talking about the Vikings is very interesting.
Yeah, I think that is the element of it. And I mean, I touch upon it in the Weird Worlds book, but in that area, there was an excavation of a Neolithic lake dwelling, and the boggy ground had preserved the archaeological finds very well. And you're talking here going back about 10,000 years, and they found a large collection of, they called them deer frontlets, and it's basically the skull of a deer, and they've sawn down the horns a bit, and then they've drilled a couple of eyes in the sort of front piece, and they were quite clearly musks. It's the only logical reason for them. And the thought was this was some form of shamanistic ritual that people would do when they were about to go hunting, that they would imbue themselves or take over the spirit of the creatures they were going to go out and hunt. You know, and we are going to be able to run and know the way of the red deer that we are hunting because we have got the spirit of the red deer flowing in us. So, you know, you're looking at something that's clearly deep down in the human mental archaeology, the psyche that we've had for a long time, that it is possible to get yourself into the spirit and the behavior of wild animals. So, you know, in the circumstances, skinwalkers are perfectly plausible and, you know, a logical thing they would do.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, before we move, I want to talk about what you're working on with your new book with witches and sorcerers. Before we move into that, while we're still in the kind of realm of folkloric creatures, I'd like to hear about the green skinny fairy folk. It sounds to me a lot like, you know, green skinny little, like maybe associated with UFO phenomenon of today. And, you know, another one of those possible connections there. So what are the green skinny fairy folk?
Right. They are in a little village about 30 miles from where I'm sitting now, just on a village called Woolpit, though the name is actually a derivation of Wolf Pit because they used to dig large holes and chase wolves and trap them in there or cover the top over so wolves would fall into them. And during the 12th century, so, you know, 1150 AD, sometime around about then, two children were discovered wandering around a field, a young boy and a slightly older girl, and they both had green skin. Neither of them spoke English or an understandable language, and they also wore strange clothes, as in the clothing they were wearing was not what the local people of that part of Suffolk wore. And the little boy didn't thrive and died quite quickly, but the girl eventually learned English, and the color of her skin, once she was living on a diet of, if you like, normal for the times food, recovered. And the tale she told was that she came from a place called Martin's Land, which was where the sun never shone, but there was just a green pallor in the sky all the time. And that she and her brother were looking after some animals for their parents. And they wandered through into a cave and came out in the field where they were found by the locals. And, you know, there's a number of theories what it is. You know, one, it ties in very much with the idea of fairy folk, because there is this idea that the fae are green. They're typically got that type of colouring, and that the land of the Fae is somehow parallel to our own world, but we can't see it. But there are certain portals you can pass through, such as caves and magical places, stone circles, and you can cross between the two realms, the realm of mankind and the other world of the Fae. So, you know, there's one idea that they may have been two young fae that had got lost. But the other idea is that, as you say, that this was the first recorded sighting of aliens. You know, the green skin being for a long time was the classic feature of aliens. I mean, we've now gone to greys and the slightly different facial conditions. I can see a picture just to your left shoulder of some showing them. But I mean, before then, you know, if you go back to the sort of golden age of science fiction in the sort of 30s and 40s, aliens were typically a bit like us, but they were a different color. And, you know, it's intriguing, you know, that it seems to tick both boxes. Were they fairies? Were they aliens? And of course, nowadays, there is a suggestion that perhaps what we regard as fairy folk may actually be aliens and have been aliens all along. It's just that in bygone times, when we thought the planet Earth was the center of everything, we assumed everything came from the planet Earth, whereas now we accept we live in a solar system and there's a galaxy and there are gazillions of other stars and planets and the potential for other life. And indeed, if you look at historically folklore sightings of fairies, they've tended to tail off in recent years, you know, since the middle of the 20th century, and aliens, which were almost completely unheard of before then, have started to become the main creature people report if they meet something strange, have a strange encounter. It's aliens. But I say, go back 100 years and people would have an alien, what we'd now call an alien encounter, but they would say it was the fairy folk. So, you know, are they the same thing that we're just putting a different name to, you know, adjusting it to our concepts? Because, you know, we have space travel, we have flight. They didn't have that 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's very possible. And they have researchers that are kind of flipping that aspect over and saying, well, maybe these have always been spiritual beings and part of our existence, just beyond the spectrum of our vision where we can't see, not necessarily from different planets or different universes, different dimensions. And, you know, that maybe they do try to help humanity or trick humanity in certain ways, little trickster entities that are definitely not what we would consider your everyday physical beings in our reality, but maybe they're physical in another reality. It's another aspect that a lot of people are starting to kind of look into and consider as well, crossing these types of ufology and paranormal tropes.
Yeah, well, I mean, fairy folk, the whole thing surrounding fairyland is that it is in a parallel dimension to ours. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going on, but we can't see it except at certain times of the year or at certain places where the boundary between the two worlds is thinner. And, you know, the trickster side of it, lot of that in fairy lore. The aspects of it tick so many boxes. And the one of the things you always hear when people are talking about encounters with the fae is that there's a strange time difference. And you have all these tales going way back to the Middle Ages of people who go off, step into, say, a fairy ring of mushrooms on the ground to dance with the fairies. And they think they've only been gone a day. And when they wake up in the morning, you know, 7 years have passed or 70 years have passed and the whole world's changed. And, you know, everybody they knew's either died or is very old and everybody thought they were dead a long time ago. So there's this sort of time element. And again, when you look at some reports of UFO abductions, there's a strange time thing that the abductee thinks they've only been gone a short time, but have been through a huge amount of activity in that time that just doesn't make sense. You know, they've traveled to another planet in some cases, and then when they wake up in their bed, it's, you know, it's only a couple of hours later. So there is this sort of similarity between ufology and aliens and with fairyland and the fae. That, you know, are they two sides of the same thing? You know, we're giving them the modern interpretation is that the UFOs, the older one, was that they were the Fae. And indeed, if you take it to its logical extreme, going back to far more ancient times, do angels fall into this same category? You know, and I suppose we have to say, are ghosts the same thing? You know, that they are just people who've moved on and are living in a different dimension and manifesting in a different way.
Yes, that is, they're all fascinating thoughts. Well, speaking of manifesting in a different way, a couple of things that I wanted to cover that I haven't heard much of stories of these, but it seems terrifying. Headless ghosts and screaming skulls. Now, I'm sure these are from ancient folklore, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the headless ghost is a very popular idea in English folklore. The most famous one is Anne Boleyn, who was the first of Henry VIII's wives to be physically parted from her head. And there's even a song from the 1930s called "With Her Head Tucked Underneath Her Arm, She Walks the Bloody Tower." And it's, a trope that it is part of English folklore, that there are headless ghosts wandering around, that, you know, they either have their head under their arm or looking for their head. There's one, a battlefield up in Scotland, where on the anniversary of the battle, a particular knight is seen riding round on his horse headless, because at the very start of the battle, a cannon went off and took his head away, and he's been looking for it for the last 600 years. And I mean, I think one of those elements is in the sort of older Christian pre-Reformation Catholic religion. There was a bit of a belief that if you were going to be resurrected, your body had to be in one piece and complete. So if you didn't have a head, if you were resurrected, you'd be resurrected as a headless person. So there was quite a bit of preciousness about and concern that your body stayed intact. I mean, as for the screaming ghosts, I mean, this is there's a number of houses in England where this is reported. And the one I'm familiar with is a place called Burton Agnes in the East Riding of Yorkshire, where a young woman in the 17th century was mugged, we'd use nowadays as the term, violently attacked, died of her injuries, and had always wanted, her father at that time was building a new home for them, a big new stately home, you know, coming to money and was going up in the world. And she always wanted to live in the new house. So she insisted that, her dying wish was that her head be removed and kept inside the house. Not surprisingly, her parents were terrified, mortified at this suggestion, and thought the poor girl was obviously suffering delirium from her injuries. However, they buried her the normal way, and there was quite clearly a ghostly presence in the house. So they reluctantly disinterred her and found that her head had somehow miraculously separated from the rest of her body. So they brought it into the house. And for a long time, once it had obviously turned into a skull, they kept it on a table in the main hall, and it was regarded as almost a good luck trophy. It brought luck to the house. And whenever anybody over the next 200 or 300 years either accidentally or deliberately threw the skull away, there would be hauntings, there would be screamings, there would be awful sounds and clatterings and disturbances at night. And then the head would be returned and peace would return. And the house still exists, and the skull isn't on public display anymore, but is in a panel in the main on the main staircase, hidden away from public viewing. And I say, all the time that the skull is there, the family's fortune is good. And I say, there are several other properties around in England where they have almost exactly the same story about them, that, you know, there's a skull and it's one of the founders, and bad luck will befall the household, the family, if it's ever removed. But of course, this yeah. also raises, going back to earlier times, the Romans in particular, they used to bury babies, sometimes people, sometimes with their heads, sometimes beheaded, in the foundations of new buildings, on the belief that they would be a protector of the building in the future. They would give it the afterworld protection. And say there's a story that London Bridge, which has been changed several times now anyway, I think the most we've got one now, but you've got a version in, is it Lake Havasu City, I think? You've got a version of it. But the original London Bridge, there's a nursery rhyme, London Bridge is falling down. And that definitely has an element talking about heads in it in some of the verses. And it's thought to be, you know, reflection of the belief that if you were going to make a new building somewhere, by burying a child or a man in the foundations, their spirit would protect it bring peace to it. Indeed, there's a place down in Kent called Reculver, where there's the remains of a Roman fort. And when they were excavating it a few years ago, they found human remains at the bases of one of the gatehouses, sort of echoing this thought that people had been sacrificed so that in the afterlife they would be there protecting the building. I mean, for me, that I always think, if I'd been sacrificed, the last thing I was going to do is protect your building. I'd right. want it. And I'd want my revenge. But
yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely want my head back, at least.
Well, I don't want, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's super fascinating. I want to get into what you're working on now, which is about witches and sorcerer. And, you know, from the earliest ones I can remember, you think of Merlin, Gandalf, where the lines of real history and fiction may have been blurred a little bit. And then you go a little bit more recent to characters like John Dee and Aleister mm-hmm. Crowley. And those are, you know, real ones that stick out in my mind throughout history. Give us a little bit of a synopsis about what you're writing about.
Yeah, it's basically an almanac. It's with the publishers now, and we're still working on the final title. But it's basically an almanac of witches and sorcerers. And it's looking at the people, the historical people, with a bit of historical context in there about the times they were living in and the background, because a lot of the stories only make sense if you understand the legal and religious times they're in. And I take it from the semi-legendary people like Circe and Medea, who are in the Greek legends, the Witch of Endor in the Bible, and take it through to modern times. And obviously Aleister Crowley's in there. He's got a huge section to himself because he is such an influential character. And, you know, a lot of modern Wicca is based on some of his writings and some of his ideas. And, you know, the early you know, the mid 20th century pioneers of modern witchcraft and Wicca, both in the United States and in England. But, you know, it's one of those fascinating things that you discover just how many people have their witchy side to them and the belief in witchcraft and how it dominated thinking and how sometimes witchcraft was perceived as good, with inverted quotes, and sometimes it was regarded as bad. I mean, you mentioned John Dee. I do have a whole section on alchemists who were out trying to find a way to convert base metals into gold. I mean, Dee was more interested in trying to, his idea of the philosopher's stone was to communicate with angels. And he has this whole idea of Enochian magic that stems from Dee. So he had, if you like, a noble idea, sort of a philosophical idea, as well as the purely money-making side of it. But for people like him, had royal patrons. In his case, it was mainly Queen Elizabeth I, because like any government, they want money. And if somebody can convert base metal, lead, into gold, that was good for the economy. So they were encouraged, and you know, they were the good guys all the time that they were apparently working and doing it correctly. Not sure whether any of them actually did produce gold and whether it was not just a bit of trickery going on there. But I mean, again, where we were talking earlier about how science and the paranormal have come together, scientists using atom splitters and this, you know, understanding of nuclear physics and the like, they can now convert base metals into gold. Unfortunately, you need reactors to do it, and it's actually cheaper to buy gold than it is to use the process. But, you know, something that again was regarded as being purely fictional, we now understand is something that can happen, does happen, and is a real thing. So, you know, John Dee, you know, is a good example of that. But again, we're coming back round to magic. Is magic something hocus pocus, or is it a form of science that we don't properly understand? Is it some form of human power, sort of PSI power that's not fully understood, that some people possess and some people can use to some effect? You know, it's back to that thing. Is it magic, or is it just science that we haven't yet discovered and don't fully understand? But I say, no, that's the book. I'm not sure on publication date. You'll be the first to know. We go through medieval history. It's strange how, you know, nowadays, if somebody is involved in a campaign to ruin someone's reputation, they'll say, oh, they've been embezzling money from the government or from the country or for the company, or they've been involved in unnatural sexual activities or whatever. Well, you know, going right back to the Roman times, that was the same then. But we'd also, people would also say, and they practice witchcraft. And I say it's a lovely allegation to make, because it's very hard to prove that you haven't come back. You aren't practicing magic. How do you stand up in court and say, I didn't practice magic 10 days ago? You can't do it. Yeah. You know, and Anne Boleyn, who we mentioned earlier, walking around with her head under her arms, she was accused of sorcery, and that she'd used sorcery to win the king's love. And there was even a rumour that she had six fingers on one hand, which is always a sign that somebody is a witch or got supernatural powers, because it's an abnormal thing. Although they have found her body and she didn't have six fingers, she only had five. But I say, it's interesting, even then, you know, it was one of the things they threw at somebody and said, ah, she's also a witch, you know, burn the witch. And obviously in the book, we look at the Salem witch trials and some of the other American cases and the background to them and the environment that caused the rise of them take it through. But again, and you know, I was fascinated to see how there are common themes that run through history from earliest times, you know, and people, when times are hard, typically you get allegations of witchcraft. They peak when times are hard, when there's a famine on, when there's a plague on, when things aren't going right, when your country's being invaded by the enemy, whatever. And people want scapegoats, and so they blame witchcraft for it. You know, they can't admit, well, the reason we've got crop failure is because we aren't planting our vegetables properly. You know, it's the reason my milk hasn't turned into butter is because a witch has looked on it and spoiled it. You know, it was a very, in superstitious times, it was a way of avoiding responsibility and making somebody else take the blame. Put it on a witch, and there were enough people who were terrified, you know, of the supernatural to believe it. And that's why you got the witch hunts of those days.
Yeah, and you were mentioning, you know, is it just a science that we don't understand yet or something more? Well, there's from my own personal experience with, you know, manifestation and mystical things and my own personal supernatural experiences, I have a knowing that there is something to it, and whether it's a science we don't understand yet or just a part of our natural existence, which I think it probably is, that there's much more to this, and if there is, there are those out there, and I'm pretty sure that there are members of high-level magical orders that do appreciate and have a knowing that this stuff is real, and maybe have a bit more knowledge of how it works and the science behind it. And they have people in very powerful positions. You know, you hear the term millionaires look at astronomy and billionaires look at astrology. So, yeah. You know, I think there's definitely something to that. And the mystical aspects of our reality, I think, are being uncovered more and more every day with, you know, each thing that's happening to make people's consciousness rise and people's awareness more broad. And I think those things are occurring during this period of time on our planet. It's very fascinating to see all this happen right now, especially with, you know, the realization of the paranormal and UFO connections, as well as the possibility that magic is a real type of tool that we can use. Now, where do you think this brings us to the future understandings of some of these concepts, like the use of magic?
Oh, I think it's a case of we're living in very interesting times. I mean, one of the issues with magic is that I don't think true practitioners ever publicly talk about it. You know, they will give you a version of it, but it's a secret that they keep within their own groups. They don't talk about it. So, you know, there's an element of mystery there that we may not ever fully understand. But again, there is a There is a doctor at one of the London universities who actually has a department that is exploring the subject of magic to try and discover what it is and how it works. And again, it's one of those things that's starting to come and be recognized that it's not just bunkum and fake science, that there is something to it.
And also you
But I
mentioned
think.
characters like Aleister Crowley, who had involvement with government agencies, CIA, project things like Project Looking Glass throughout our Black Project history, and projects looking into time travel and telekinesis and psychic activity, and all these government-funded and high-level organized studies on this stuff. You know, there has to be something to it if these guys are looking at it too, you know?
I mean, the Project Looking Glass is a fascinating area of that. And again, the idea is that these people have certain psychic powers that enable them to do it. Which comes back to the earlier point that, you know, is magic just another power that we have that we don't fully recognize and can't, most people can't control or manipulate. No, I it is very, very intriguing. And I say Aleister Crowley is such a strange character. And I mean, he worked for the British security services in the First World War and to an extent in the Second World War, and even worked with Ian Fleming, who, you know, went on to write the James Bond novels. So that there is this overlap, and you know, there's Jack Parsons, who was an early pioneer of rocketry in North America, and he was a firm believer in Crowley-type magical forces. And he died in very mysterious circumstances, which may have been a purely an accident, or it may have been a murder. And there is one suggestion it was he was killed by American security services who were concerned he was going to leave the country and take his secrets with him. You know, he was talking about possibly going to work for the Israelis and the 1950s. So, you know, there's lots of mysteries out there, and we're no closer to finding a definitive answer. I think that's why it's so endlessly fascinating, because there isn't a simple answer to it. And you know, we may never find all the answers, but you know, the attraction, the challenge is to keep looking and to keep searching for them.
Yes, I think that's a perfect note to end on today, Charles. I want to thank you again so much for coming on. That was fantastic as usual. And for the audience that wants to find out more about you and pick up some of your books, what's the best way for them to do so?
Best way is to go to my website, which is www.urbanfantasist. That's fantasist as opposed to fantasy.com. And you'll find all the links and the links to the books and everything else you need to know there. And you can also find the books on Amazon.
Fantastic. Well, Charles, thank you so much. And we'll definitely be talking again sometime in the future.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a delight as ever. Thank you very much.
All right, everyone. Until next time, have an excellent evening. And we'll talk again sometime, maybe tonight. I don't know, but definitely tomorrow. Are you at a crossroads in life with unanswered questions? How does your past connect to your present life? October Hallam can help you discover how your past connects to your present and is shaping your future. October is an intuitive, healer, empath, and medium with over 20 years of experience helping people navigate through some of life's greatest challenges. A recent client from Egypt says, "October is pure magic. We keep coming back for more," and recommended her to our closest friends. If you would like to book a session with October, please contact her at theancientgift222@gmail.com.